Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to The Political Party. This episode features Penny Mordaunt, Trade Minister and the first ever woman to be Secretary of State for Defence. Penny has led an incredible life, full of weird and wonderful jobs. We talk about some of those and some hair-raising experiences she's had. But before that, don't forget you can email the show, politicalpartypodcast@gmail.com. With encounters you've had with politicians, they can be exciting or they can be mundane. All of them count. Toby's been in touch. He said, it must have been 1987 or 88. I love a historical one. I mean, some of you must have even older ones than this. So please get in touch. He says, we were living in Hounslow and used to go to the Brentford Waterman's Art Centre for a bit of culture now and then. Good for you, Toby. Don't forget, you can get live culture every other Monday at the Duchess Theatre. Tickets at mattford.com/live. He said, one evening, we'd parked and we're heading for the entrance behind a middle-aged couple. I love the detail. It's 1987, years ago. I turned back to say something to my wife and didn't notice the man ahead of me was holding the door open for us. As a result, I trod on his foot, turned to apologise and realised it was Neil Kinnock. He was very gracious, and a few minutes later, when I raised a pint to him across the curved bar, he winked at me. Lovely man, very warm. Well, as listeners of this show will know, Neil Kinnock has cropped up a few times in these stories. He's probably the most spotted in these emails. But it's always a very, very pleasant story, which is no surprise at all, of course. So if you've had a strange, a surreal, or even a mundane encounter with a politician, email the show, politicalpartypodcast@gmail.com. This, of course, is one of the new live shows every fortnight now at the wonderful Duchess Theatre in London's glittering West End, which is such a treat. The next one is on Monday, the 25th of October, with Caroline Flynn. What's great about this new run is there's so many people. Obviously, I've had some people on before. I've had people on the live shows. I've interviewed people over Zoom, then had them on live. So many people I've never had the chance to interview before. And Caroline Flynn has always been on that top list. And I'm delighted she's finally been able to do it. So the Monday, the 25th of October at the Duchess Theatre in London, my guest will be the brilliant Caroline Flynn. That is not a night to be missed. As you know, I'm sure, from Caroline when she was in politics and now that she's in broadcasting and many other areas, she does not mince her words. She's very passionate, very articulate, very thoughtful and outspoken. So that promises to be a brilliant night, particularly when that new Labour documentary is fantastic. And so many of you got in touch to say you enjoyed the John Rental episode. And he's such a great talker, John. I wish I could do his course. But on the back of that, so great to talk to someone who served in that time and observed the Blair and Brown government from within. So that will be a real treat. Caroline Flynn, Monday the 25th of October at the Duchess Theatre. 2 weeks after that, Anna Sawar, the new leader of Scottish Labour, one of the biggest stars, one of the biggest rising stars in the Labour universe. And that is on Monday the 8th of October, 8th of November, sorry. The standing ovation he got at the Labour Party conference when Keir Starmer name-checked him was significant. So it's obvious he's not just popular in Scotland, he's popular across Britain. So two fantastic Labour guests coming up. Tickets for those shows and for all future shows, including Anthony Scaramucci, Jeremy Hunt, the Christmas special, and all the dates next year, of which guests are soon to be announced, are available at mattford.com/live. And there's a link in the blurb where you can just click and buy the tickets. There's also a link to Penny Mordaunt's brilliant book, Greater, which we talk about. But it's a really interesting concept of a book. She co-authored it with someone that she doesn't necessarily share the politics of. We talk about the reasons for that. But also, it looks back, and it doesn't necessarily look back. It's an assessment of the British character, but it also looks forward with some of the answers about how we can solve our society. So, as well as that, and some amazing stories from her incredible life. Of course, in this in these live shows, there's a bit of stand-up. I began by talking about the Prime Minister's party conference speech. Some of the things that he does, you think, he sort of traps you, really good at trapping you in logic, where you go, we have, in the UK, yes, we have one of the most lopsided economies in Europe, one of the most imbalanced societies. You know? Yeah, I agree, but you have been in charge for 11 years, yes, it's terrible, isn't it? Yeah. So you agree with me? Oh, fuck. Yeah, I think I do, yeah. Well, hang on a minute. What do you do about it? Well, what would Labour do about it? Oh, fuck, man. You got me again. How do you do this? Well, where do we go now? Where do you want to go? No, stop. Right, that's gone far enough. Apparently, before his speech, I think he delivered it really well, but apparently before his speech, his pre-speech drink was a flat white coffee with extra caramel syrup and three sugars. No wonder he always looks like that. He can't fucking stand still. Fucking hell, even if he tried to comb his hair, it wouldn't work. I mean, that is the least prime ministerial drink. A flat white with extra caramel and three sugars. That is not the drink of a leader. But like on that new Labour documentary, Tony Blair saying, well, look, before the night of the Iraq speech, I had a couple of umbongos. I think it was really important. I don't know if you remember umbongo, it's around sort of a hippo, tuck, a guava and an apricot, a mango. And I just felt it was the right sort of thing. You know, I needed to be clear. I needed something that was vaguely fruit-based, but that also had sugar. And you know, Mandelson there going, of course, no, Tony was very clever having umbongo. I thought it was masterful. No, I always felt that that was New Labour. I thought Tony was very and I thought Gordon was more bongo. No,
that's not my recollection at all. No. No, my recollection is that Tony would have umbongos and then give the rest to me. That's not my recollection at all. Rishi Sunak? Do people like Rishi Sunak's speech? Even the people who went to Tory conferences. I thought it was interesting about his speech. The first one I've ever seen, where he had a sort of like pre-gig video that brought him on. And it said sort of like more jobs, the fastest growing economy in the G7, and then Rishi Sunak, the kind of signature. You think, there aren't many Tory chancellors in history that could have done that. Norman Lamont, 15% interest rates, 12% inflation, Black Wednesday, by Norman. Austerity, by George Osborne. Welcome into the stage. It does a weird thing, Rishi Sunak. The sort of kissy lips. I never noticed it. Whatever it takes. Sort of fishy, Sunak. It's sort of, I don't know, it's like, is he blowing kisses? But it kind of works. It's so interesting when you see politicians be nakedly ambitious, because when you watch that new Labour documentary, Gordon Brown would always couch it in sort of political language, but Rishi Sunak's speech, basically a 20-minute CV, at one point he went, my years in California left a real mark on me. You're like, mate, you're the Chancellor. You're not at a job interview. I work very well in a team. And if I have a weakness, it's probably that I'm a workaholic and a bit of a perfectionist. Dominic Raab! Oh, man! The gift that keeps on giving with a very quiet voice, Dominic Raab. Misogyny, I disagree with misogyny, whether it's a woman being misogynistic to a man or a man being misogynistic to a woman. Well, yeah, I mean, I disagree with misogyny if it's a woman doing it to a man, because that's impossible, you fucking idiot. We're all against it. Islamophobia is wrong, whether it's an atheist against a Muslim or a Muslim against a fox. Doesn't make any sense, mate. His big idea, by the way, this hasn't had nearly enough coverage, to solve our lorry driver shortage, Dominic Raab, Mr. sort of tough guy, wants to let criminals fill the labour gap and drive lorries full of things like petrol. Dominic, of all the people in the government, Dominic Raab said, I think we should let criminals do it. You're like, what could possibly go right? What do you mean that oil tank hasn't turned up? No. It was meant to arrive 5 hours ago. Well, I don't see what could possibly have gone wrong unless you don't think the driver, Alan the arsonist, has something to do with this. Fucking hell. The whole lorry thing is just so sad, because we're going to get a load of people back that we basically told to piss off to drive our lorries. Do you know what we're going to send them back? Christmas Eve. The cruelest date of the year. Those temporary visas are going to expire. A load of lorry drivers going home on Christmas Eve. It's going to be like that Coca-Cola advert in reverse. So sad. Gary Neville got involved in politics this week. Very left-wing, Gary Neville. He said, all I know about the Tory party is they look after themselves. This cancellation of £20 universal credit uplift is a disgrace. And you think, I don't mind people talking about politics. It's weird when it's someone I watch talk like that about football all the time. And they're not talking. I don't know if anyone else had that. I can't get my. I always expected Jamie Carragher to go, no. I'm not saying, Gary, that I'm not saying I agree with the Tories. All I'm saying is, you hand out 20 quid to everyone. That's going to be inflationary. Because, yes, they are, Gary. No, you're not listening. No, because someone else says, we're giving him 20 quid. Well, I want 20 quid. And that's what happens, right? How many people are there in the UK? Well, 55 million. That's 20 quid a week to everybody. That's £1 billion a week, Gary. That you can't say that's not inflationary. What are the pair of yarn about? Don't, you got it the wrong way round. No. Jamie, it's the wrong way round. No, you need wages to keep up with prices. No, it's prices that are going too fast. The wages are going too slow. You don't even understand Keynesianism. I don't know why you're on this programme. Well, coming up after the break, Manchester United against Manchester City and a detailed discussion about the effect of the exchange rate on interest rates and inflation. That's all coming up live on Sky. I'd watch that. The phrase they use now that they're trying to get Starmer to buy into is Southgate patriotism, which, as far as I can aware, is what most people believe it is. Proud to be English, not proud of the racist people that are still knocking about. I mean, it's really not that hard to go, yeah, I like them actually. I want people where I'm from to win. Oh, yeah. Isn't that what we've always believed? Like, but people in the Labour Party are like, God, how do we solve this problem? Southgate, yeah, let's give it a thing. Southgate was really good at just trying to bring people along, and I think that's probably what they respected, you know, very much. I think, you know, you look towards the end of the tournament, I think, you know, perhaps some of our supporters weren't quite getting the message about why we were... like, just have an antihistamine. What the fuck is going on with your face? It looks like he's got hay fever. He's got the worst job in the world, always stood on the edge of a massive park. Oh. I think some of our players perhaps did react to that, but towards the, you know, look at the performance levels towards the end of the tournament. You just think, actually, I'd like them to go one step further now, because just saying, oh, well, people don't get it, was fine for then, but actually it ruins it for everyone else, let alone the players. And I would, for Qatar, if we're talking about morality in football, for the Qatar World Cup, that hopefully all the home nations will be at. I would like to see him go one further. But the beauty of Southgate, and this is the lesson for politics, is to be able to articulate quite a crunchy message, probably in quite a tactful way still. Well, I think as we do look towards the World Cup, I think perhaps we do have to confront the fact that we wouldn't like a lot of our own supporters there. We'd rather perhaps attract a different demographic, because some of those people at Wembley were cunts. Yeah. You put it like that, Gareth, I think you bring all of us on board with you. Obviously, Starmer hasn't managed that yet. I mean, his speech when he got heckled by... The whole thing, what I found hilarious about Starmer's speech was, the whole goal of it was to say, we've moved on. And all the people heckling him just proved that the Labour Party isn't what it was even 2 years ago. But they heckled him while he was talking about his mum dying. It was just like the worst... I mean, who knew anti-Semitic communists were unreasonable people? Oh, now I understand what's terrible about these people. I wish, actually, because some of his, he dealt with it quite well. I said, usually at this time on a Wednesday, it's the Tories heckling me. Doesn't bother me there, doesn't bother me now. I thought, oh, that's quite sweet. I would have liked him to see him use some standard comedy club heckle put-downs. Yeah, save your breath, mate. You'll need it to inflate your girlfriend later. That would have been nice, wouldn't it? But he had a breakfast that caused a lot of fuss. I don't know if you saw this, he had fish and cheese. That old classic. I mean, obviously what's happened is, he's got late, gone to the breakfast buffet, and that's all that's been left. But everyone's sort of been going, why is he having fish and cheese for breakfast? What a strange guy. Like, if you're at a premiere and you get up early, otherwise you miss out on the bubble and squeak sausage and beans. Everyone knows this, right? Apparently I'm the only one in this room that knows it. You get your breakfast, your good night guarantee from £29. We all know, it turns out me and Lenny Henry are the only two people that know this. But everyone was sort of overanalyzing, going, oh, fish and cheese, he's got fish. Like, I mean, who cares if that's what he wants for breakfast anyway? Like, this is the problem, that in politics now, and I'm in danger of this sometimes, you kind of overanalyze every little detail. You're like, if you'd ever had a croissant, people said, ah, They're gonna lobby to rejoin the EU. That's what that is. Sending a signal to the Blairites, this prick. And if he had a full English to go, oh, here we go, signalling to the far right, the guy's basically a racist. Sausage and ash browns, we hear you loud and clearly. That's a bowl of Cocoa Pops, he's a paedophile. You can't win.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm absolutely delighted that we have tonight's guest here. Makes it sound like she wasn't going to turn up. She threatened to pull out. Because she is one of the biggest stars in modern British politics, someone I've wanted to interview for a very long time. That's a catchphrase for newcomers, by the way. It's the closest thing this show gets to any sort of meaningful structure, so enjoy it. And was the first ever female Secretary of State for Defence. Is now a trade minister and has come to talk to us about all the wonderful deals we're going to do now that we've left the European Union. Please give a wonderful, rousing political party welcome to Penny Mordaunt.
Hello.
Penny, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Got a beer on the go there?
I have. Thank you very much.
That's all right. I've provided you with a glass because I forgot to give Andy Burnham a glass the other week.
Did he complain?
He kicked up a bit of a fuss, yeah.
Oh, well, I'm from Portsmouth.
Does that mean you'll kick up more of a fuss?
No, no, I'm fine. I'm fine. I'm fine with a tinny. That's fine.
But seaside towns, that's the thing. You know, they can get a bit frisky. Well, frisky's not right. I mean, like, fights break out. I don't know if that's something you've ever experienced.
I've not been involved in one, but I've seen a few. Yes.
I wasn't going to talk to you about this, but I once did a Christmas gig in Portsmouth, and they said, oh, it's fine, you know, it was down at the Spinnaker Tower. And it's this place down in Portsmouth that has, like, a glass back. So it looks out onto the sea, but the stage was facing the audience, so behind me was the sea. And basically, a fight broke out during the gig. This was, like, the 23rd of December, because someone said the air conditioner was on too high, and someone said, no, I think it's too cold. So the guy who said it was too cold got knocked out by the guy who said it was too high. He got thrown out, but then he realised he could get back in that door, so he ran round the back. So everyone sort of saw him run along the seafront, and then he came in that door and knocked two guys out. So, Portsmouth, eh?
Well, Spinnaker Tower is a bit... That's kind of uptown. The notorious place in Portsmouth was Joanna's nightclub, which was legendary. I had a carpet cleaning job when I was going through college. And I remember going into Joanna's nightclub and losing the sole of my shoe on the floor. It was that kind of place. But yeah, Joanna's was where, if you wanted a proper fight, that's where
you'd go. That's where you'd go. I wasn't going to open this. In terms of carpet cleaning, I spilt some... Genuinely, this Saturday, I've got a cream carpet and spilt some sweet chilli sauce on it, and I've put everything on there I can find on the internet. I've got no idea how to get it out.
Do you know, of all the questions I prepared for tonight, that was not one of them. But I can sort you out. I can sort you out with people that know about that stuff.
Yeah, Dr. Kaufman's is really good.
What is?
Dr. Kaufman.
Dr. Kaufman.
Oh, there we go, yeah.
Okay, and does he do appointments? I think it was Dr. Otica that I spilt on the carpet, actually. So what's the medical world doing in the world of carpet?
Do you work for them?
No, but I also have cream carpet and a very messy husband.
Oh, there we go.
A cream carpet and a messy husband. Oh, what a life. So, Penny, good of you to be here. So you're not on holiday, you're staying to work.
I'm not in Marbs, no, I'm here. No.
Do you think it's okay? It's all right for politicians to take holidays, isn't it?
I think it is all right for politicians to take holidays. I think our Prime Minister has demonstrated a Nelsonian style of leadership, and he's in charge still, so that's fine by me.
When you say Nelsonian, do you mean like as in successful or kind of like at sea?
No, he picks his team, he's got his Collingwoods, he delegates.
Loves being on a boat.
Loves being on a boat.
Because you're like an honorary admiral or something in the
world. Captain. I'm a captain. Yeah.
So I'm not great on military rank, so captain is lower down than an admiral.
Correct.
Or higher. So, and what does your honorary captaincy mean you can do?
So honoraries do a whole raft of things for the Navy, and it depends on your skills, what you do. So there are some people that do really technical stuff, and I basically give some advice to the First Sea Lord and his management team. And then when I go to sea, I talk to all of the messes on all of the ships. So I talk to the senior rates mess and the junior ranks and the officers mess, and just try and find out how I can make their lives better, basically.
So it actually involves doing stuff?
Yeah.
I thought it was like an honorary doctorate, where you're like, I don't know, Marcus Rashford operating on me, like.
No, so the last time I was at sea was right before the pandemic, because obviously we've been restricted on what we can do, and I was on HMS Albion, getting her ready for her deployment. So we were doing sea boat drills, gunnery, all sorts of stuff. I was there helping find, you know, snagging, that sort of stuff.
So what's snagging? I don't understand anything about the Navy. Although I've seen Vigil with Martin Compston, is it basically? Sort of
no, it's not. No, we just try and get things to run better. Continuous improvement, all that sort of stuff that we do in government really well. that's what the Navy does.
So the armed forces are in your blood, 'cause your dad was a paratrooper. I mean, I remember being told at school they're basically like the hardest people in the military.
Yeah.
Was he like a tough guy?
Yeah, he was. He was. I mean, I didn't know him when he was serving, but he then went on to be a PE teacher, and then he became a youth worker, and he did some amazing work actually with lots of kids that needed some help. So he's still going strong. He's 80, and he lives near me, which is good because he needs someone to keep an eye on him, because I think once a para, always a para.
Goes into Portsmouth on a Friday night.
He's not at Joanna's. No, he's not at Joanna's. But yeah, he's great.
You obviously, I mean, it's so cool when you get someone who ends up holding a brief that actually means something to them, or that they have experience. So often in government, it's not the case. So coming from that military background, then ending up as Secretary of State for Defence, I mean, it must have been a proud moment for you, but he must have been very proud at that moment.
Yeah, he was. I mean, I don't think he quite knows what I do for a living, but... yeah, it was a proud moment. I think also being the first woman was pretty special as well. And normally when there's a reshuffle, you go into number 10, you're given your new brief, and then you go straight into the department. And when I went in, my office was full of flowers from all the serving women there, which was quite a lovely moment.
That's really... I mean, I imagine that obviously as the first woman, it must have meant so much to a lot of people.
I think so, because... The armed forces, why they're so good at all the diversity stuff is because they know that it makes you more operationally effective. So knowing they've got a woman around the board table in defence, I think meant a lot to them.
And what's it like being a woman in the defence world?
It's a privilege, whether you're a man or a woman, to work alongside these amazing people. I mean, every day was just so special. Obviously, I was Secretary of State, but... Prior to that, for about 18 months, I was Minister of State for the Armed Forces, again, the first woman to do that. And at a really kinetic time for this country, lots of operations, and it was amazing. These individuals are incredible. I think we know that they're very brave and they make lots of sacrifices, but I think most people have no idea what they do, really, and the hardships that they endure. So there were really quite profound moments, and then... hilarious ones as well. A few life and death experiences occasionally, and they're just a great bunch of people. I'm very privileged.
It sort of breezed over a few life and death experiences, but great people. So, what were the life and death experiences?
Well, I began to think there was a bit of a conspiracy to get me to up their maintenance budgets, particularly on helicopters. Because I was jinxed, and I had a few quite hairy moments in several helicopters, including one where we were over the Aegean Sea and we lost power, and it was a difficult situation because we had the pilot and the observer were on comms and I was on comms, but we had three other people. It was a Wildcat helicopter, and they couldn't hear what was going on. So this whole episode is immortalised because the only way I could tell my military assistant that we were about to crash into the sea, which we didn't in the event, we managed to get to land.
Spoiler alert.
I know. I lived. Was to type on my phone and hand the phone to him. So this is the conversation we had is on my wall in my office. It is hilarious. We were very calm and... And at one point, as we're discussing, you know, how to get the door open, and what do we get out before we've gone under the water and all that sort of stuff, we pause and just admire the calmness of the observer and the pilot, who were literally there, happy as Larry, photographing the instruments in case none of us survived. This happened frequently to me, which is why I thought it was a bit of a conspiracy theory
So once over the Aegean Sea, I mean, how you know when you lose power? Are you just dropping like a stone?
No, we were fairly steady, but we had to. We made it by turning off basically everything we didn't need to keep us in the air. So we were all right, but it was quite touch and go for a while.
So that, I mean, obviously I don't know how helicopters work, but like, is it like someone like we're losing power? And you go, oh, sorry, I was charging my iPad.
It was what? That kind of thing.
Yeah, what else are you turning on? I'm surely everything there helps.
We had one of the passengers was a guy from the embassy who was a nervous flyer. So we decided not to tell him anything until the last moment. But he did emerge, not knowing anything had happened. So we were all very calm.
And the other times, was it like that, or was it more?
Well, you just get to do really amazing things and go to parts of the world you wouldn't normally see, and see incredible heroic acts and service. It's a privilege.
And also, guns, planes, nukes. You know, all the kind of. Obviously, it's very important that we live up to our international responsibilities, but also like cool stuff.
Yeah, there's quite a lot of that.
So, like, what's like the coolest thing that you've like played with?
the really cool stuff I can't tell you about. I'm sorry.
Okay. Like, what's the least?
But you know, well, getting onto a submarine at sea is pretty cool.
Oh my god! What? Joining it at sea?
Yeah. I've done that. I presented. The first women submariners with their dolphins. So when you have done your first tour as a submariner, you are presented with your dolphins, which is the badge you wear as a submariner. And they're presented to you not by pinning them on you, but they put them in a large tot of rum, and you have to down it in one and catch the dolphins in your teeth. So I joined one of our bomber subs on her route back in. And presented the first women to have done a tour with their dolphins, which was quite cool.
And do you have to do every shot with them?
You don't have to, but I did.
Because that's one thing people say about like the armed forces, like the sort of hard drinking culture. Like, were you comfortable?
I think that has changed. That they do know how to have a good time, but I think it's different to what it was like when my father was serving, for example.
And it must, I mean, this sounds like such a sort of novice thing to ask, but a submarine feels like a very claustrophobic, scary place. I mean, I'm basing that obviously on The Hunt for Red October, Vigil with Martin Compston, The Widowmaker. Is it as kind of like hot and low-ceilinged as it looks?
So I think our modern submarines are very, very big. And you don't appreciate how big they are because you only see a tiny portion of them. Normally, it's when you see them in dry dock you really it's jaw dropping when you do see the whole thing. But it's not so much the sort of crampedness and all of that. It's the fact that, I mean, if you have been if you're a senior rate on a submarine, you will have spent at least 10 years of your life underwater. And to me, that's mind-blowing that people are prepared to do that to keep this country safe. It's those sorts of things. And, you know, the fact that you can't communicate with your family, it's really incredible what these people do. And I think it's one of the... I've been doing quite a bit of work, actually, with the submarine service because... And I think they're going to start to tell a bit more of a story about the service because they have to recruit to it. And it's a service that you get to do some very, very cool stuff in.
Yeah.
But no one ever gets to hear about it. So I'm hoping they're going to be able to tell the story a bit more. But I've been involved with some fundraising recently to get a proper submariner's memorial at the Royal Arboretum because there isn't one, really. So every service... They deserve one.
Obviously, different memorials have different things. I mean, would that be just a sort of big bottle of rum with a plastic dolphin in it?
No, it's. I can't tell you what it's going to be like, but it is. It is a stunning memorial. So
I can't get somebody underwater for 10 years.
Yeah, yeah.
And like, how often would they sort of pop off?
So if you, I mean, in a modern submarine, you the only reason why you need to surface is to take on food. So they will stay submerged for 3 months.
Oh my God.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And what's food like?
Well, it's pretty good actually.
Yeah. Oh, I just, you know what? It's one of those things where I sort of presume it's hard, but it's only when you hear that you realise sort of how severe the experience is. So, being in a kind of claustrophobic, stressful environment with people who are drinking rum, how did that prepare you
for
cabin?
They don't do that every day. It's not like, you know, brush your teeth, take your tot of rum. Those days have gone. But serving in the armed forces is it's all of those things that you don't see. It's the I remember during 2015 when we had all the terrible floods. I went up to thank the UK Standby Battalion for they were doing a lot of the work rescuing people and sandbags and all that sort of stuff. And there was a chap there who his brother was getting married, and they were working so hard and they had so little flex that he couldn't go to his brother's wedding. It's all of those sorts of things. And it's one of the only services where you have that level of commitment and you sign up and you do it, which is why I think we always need to make sure that the military are of a particular size. It's not just about expeditionary warfare. It's about all the other stuff we ask them to do. And we should pay them well.
And how do you feel about Afghanistan then and our withdrawal from there? Because coming from a military background, understanding Britain's role in the world and understanding the role that our armed forces play in that, most people seem to think it's the wrong decision.
So I've been reflecting on this because I'm always interested in why things happen. Why do people choose to do particular things, even if people think that they're not the most the easiest route or the smartest thing to do. I was reflecting on, the decision that Margaret Thatcher took to retake the Falkland Islands, for example, which people were saying at the time was not the strategically right thing to do. And it comes down to political will. And I think that, I mean, I have to say, I think Ben Wallace did an amazing job as Defence Secretary, and he I think did everything he could to try and get a coalition and a different exit, but was not able to do that. But ultimately, this is why political thinking really matters, because it determines things like that. And we, people have not, they've been very critical about how we've done in Afghanistan and the things that we've enabled. And I think over that terrible period, you saw exactly the things that had been achieved and how much it meant to people there. I've been to Afghanistan many times over many years, and I'd say to anyone who served in any of those campaigns that this won't undo what you achieved for people. Half of that population has only ever known the freedom and the security space that those people provided.
Just feel like you're such a success. Why are we ending it?
Well, ultimately, people have decided that it is not, it's not something that they want to be involved in. And it does, I know you did a podcast with Tom Tugendhat, and he said, it does feel like a defeat, but it's not a victory for the Taliban. The Taliban have won a lifetime of servitude for their mothers, girlfriends, sisters. They've won terrorism, which we're now seeing unfold. It's they're not victors in this. It's an extremely sad situation, and I'm still involved with trying to obviously get people out, but also protect people there, particularly women, and also enable girls to continue to have an education. So we're looking to try and accredit a course that they can do online, but it also will mean something if they want to and have the opportunity to go and study somewhere else.
Because everyone, I mean, Ben Wallace, you mentioned that clip of him on LBC, he just looked absolutely stricken. When I spoke to Tom Tugendhat, these people are really upset by the decision. I mean, you look moved when you talk about it.
So, of course, we know a lot of people who are involved, but I don't think we need to be upset. I think we need to show some defiance. That's what I think.
But wouldn't the best act of defiance be to stay there and fight the Taliban?
Well, as I say, it's about political will.
Because it's such, I mean, the problem is with Afghanistan, it just feels like, I don't understand the logic of it, because people say, well, we went there because, you know, the Taliban harbored Al-Qaeda, became this hotbed for terrorism, and, you know, the way the Taliban treated its own people, and then us being there stopped all that, and then you can only really conclude that us leaving is then going to lead to that happening again. Or am I wrong?
So, no, you will see that. And I think that the thinking from America is that it also becomes China's problem. But I think it will be our problem as well. One thing that British servicemen and women and our allies did was keep our streets safe. And there is a direct link between the security space that they provided in Afghanistan and what was happening back here. So, yeah, that's not a good thing.
It does feel like sort of a grim situation. So let's move on to sort of happier times, happier places. The Conservative Party has been in Manchester for its conference.
Love your link between Afghanistan and Conservative Party conference.
Are you a fan of Conservative Party conference? And did it feel like a successful week?
So I was only there for 24 hours because I was...
You're on a helicopter, it was losing altitude.
Absolutely. No, I was trying to get some petrol for my constituents, so I decided that was my priority. But I went for the Tuesday, and it was all right, it was good.
And did you enjoy Boris's big speech?
I wasn't in the hall, but I listened to it, and yeah, I think a lot of the time people say you need to announce a lot of policy. You don't need to announce a lot of policy. You need to set out a vision, you need to boost morale and tell people that, you know, what we're up to.
And what's he like as a Prime Minister to deal with?
I've always got on with him. I've worked with him quite closely when I was Secretary of State for International Development, and he was over at the Foreign Office. And rather than have separate meetings, I decided it was a good idea for us, all of our ministers, to be around the table. So that we were working together, and got on with him fine.
And is he sort of more impressive behind the scenes, or is he kind of as he appears?
I think that's what people like about him, because that is who he is.
Is he on top of the detail? As a Prime Minister, you think, oh, actually, he's adding value here. He's sat there going, Penny, come on. We're doing all this international. Oh, can't we cut some of this godforsaken?
Well, he knows what he wants to achieve. And he finds the people that he thinks can do it. And he gives them very clear instructions. And he expects them to crack on.
Because obviously, at the moment, is the government broadly on side of them? Are ministers kind of... deeply loyal to him? Does it feel like a Prime Minister is in control of his own government?
The government does not resemble Joanna's nightclub, if that's what you're if that's what you're getting at. Yeah.
What were the Theresa May years like? Because one of the things that I found fascinating about that was a Remainer trying to deliver a soft Brexit, and it kind of scattered people all over the place. There's an amazing account of that cabinet meeting where Theresa May's putting a deal, and then people who she might have thought were going to be against it sound like they're against it, but then they come out in favour. But apparently you were very firm in rejecting the deal, and that was a sort of big moment around the cabinet table. Is that how you remember it?
So, yes. I mean, it didn't make any difference at all, I'm afraid. I think it was an incredibly difficult time, and for all kinds of reasons. I felt it was always very difficult for a Remainer to try and deliver Brexit, because they had to in a way, demonstrate their Brexity credentials. And
yes.
And what you actually wanted at that time was the opposite. You wanted someone that people would trust because they thought it was the right thing to do, but didn't have to do all of the kind of flag-waving stuff and could really reach out to the other side of the argument and bring people together. And I still think, although, you know, it's been a turbulent few years, it actually demonstrated the strengths of our country and our system of government and parliament and the courts and our unwritten constitution, because ultimately, although there were huge differences with how people saw, you know, what our relationship should have been like with the EU, people largely agreed on the process. And I've always said the heroes of that whole episode were not people like me that voted to leave. They were people that voted to remain and accepted the democratic result. And that, to me, is the sign not of a divided country, but a strong country.
Well, on behalf of those of us who voted to remain, thank you so much. I didn't realise I was the hero of Brexit. I'm not sure how I feel about it.
That's how I feel about it.
But maybe I'm just seeing this through the Blair Brown lens, but the thought, I mean, what's odd is, and I think the public often imagine that all MPs are very powerful, that ministers and cabinet ministers are powerful, and they're comfortable speaking around a cabinet table. But actually, then you see these documentaries, you go, oh God, it feels kind of awful, and it can be awkward to sometimes say what you think around the cabinet table at an awkward moment. I mean, did it feel awkward, or did it feel completely comfortable?
No, I think if you're there, there's no. If you're not going to say what you think and you're not going to give your best advice, you know, do something else. The only time I did get a bit cross at one point where, because what I think was frustrating was that you'd have very, very long cabinet meetings and then you'd realise the decision had already been taken. And on a couple of occasions, so that no one went off and said something they shouldn't, we were held in a sort of pen, the cabinet, given some wine whilst a statement was made outside. And this meeting had overrun, and I had a bunch of school kids waiting for me in Parliament. I was supposed to be telling them about democracy. And I thought, you know, sod this. I'm not hanging back for this. So I attempted to escape. And you couldn't get out the front because that's where the sort of piece to camera was going on. But out the back of number 10, there's this joining bit to the cabinet office, and it's sort of this little tube that you go into, and a security guard makes sure you're allowed through, and then you go through. Anyway, I made it to the tube, and I persuaded someone that I was legitimately allowed to go through and use their pass to get through. And I'd made it halfway down the cabinet corridor to get out of the front of the cabinet office. Anyway, the security team were alerted, and they told this poor security guard, who was just sort of manning the door, that I had to be stopped, I wasn't allowed out. And he informed me of this, and I gave him some options, and he let me go. So, but that was the only time I behaved badly and unprofessionally throughout that whole period. So I did lose it. I just thought, I'm going to go and talk to my school children.
What were the options?
Well, I gently inquired how he was going to do that. He was going to stop me leaving. And we both agreed he'd done his job. So he let me go.
Ex-military, because you've got like military, you know, connections. I bet you're quite good in a situation like that.
Tunneling out of the cabinet.
Yeah, camouflage.
It wasn't very hard. It wasn't very difficult.
So people, presumably the others, stayed just drinking wine.
Yeah.
How long were they there for?
I don't know.
David Davis is probably still there. So get another bottle of red.
I think he'd resigned by that point. So, no.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
But obviously, sort of, it's not the right phrase to use, sort of confidence tricks, but misdirection is part of your history because you worked in magic for many years.
I did, yes. To put myself through my A-levels, I worked Friday and Saturday nights for a fantastic chap called Will Ayling, who was president of the Magic Circle, and I was his assistant.
So, I mean, you make it, again, he's like, oh, let's get myself through here, I was a magician assistant. It's not a sort of standard weekend job, like paperboy working a bar. What attracted you to magic?
Well, I didn't go looking for the job. It sort of came to me, really.
That's magic.
It's magic, it's magic. Yeah, and I thought, right, this is interesting, I'll do this for a while.
But how does it, what, did you know the guy, or do you...
So, I knew his previous assistant, because she was retiring.
She'd been sorted
off. She'd had enough. So,
There meant to be blood on this, right?
Yeah.
But was it scary? I mean, it's a strange old world magic to an outsider. Did you think, oh God, what if he puts the sword through?
So it's not really frightening. You're not worried that something's going to go wrong. But some of the illusions were, got cut occasionally. Yeah.
You got cut.
Yeah. if you hadn't got your limbs in the right place at the right moment, you could come a cropper.
So when they're putting swords, so it is genuinely dangerous then.
Yeah, if you mess up, which obviously I did on a frequently, but it was a great time. It was great fun, and it enabled me. I was able to, spend only a short time my week doing that, earning some good money, and could get on with all sorts of other things.
And what were you best at in magic? What was that? Did you have a favourite trick?
So, this chap was famous for an illusion called zigzag, which is where you get into a box and then these very large steel blades are pushed through at all angles.
Yeah.
And then the middle part of you, which contains your stomach and your hands, are removed and sent somewhere else in the room. That was his sort of signature. He designed that.
I mean, it sounds... Not
if I'd
great
known
for you.
You were interested, Matt, I could have, brought it along.
Yeah. So it's sort of Copperfield level, Matt. He wasn't doing David Blaine stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, he worked with David Copperfield on some illusions.
So you know how all the big magic tricks are done?
Yes, I do. And I'm telling you now, if I tell you how they're done, it will ruin magic forever for you. So I'm not going to do that.
Do you know how Derren Brown does this stuff?
I think when you know the basics and you know you can spot when people are deliberately distracting people and that sort of thing, you can spot how the principles behind a trick. Yeah.
And how does that inform your relationship with Boris Johnson?
It doesn't.
But it was so. Was part of? Did part of you think actually? I wouldn't mind a career in showbiz. Did that ever sort of, was that ever in your mind?
No, not really. I knew I wanted a career working in politics, but I didn't think I'd ever be in the front line of it. And I think it was a combination of my upbringing. I had a lot of responsibility at a young age. And then when I was 18, I went to work in post-revolutionary Romania because I hadn't got anything else to do. So I went and worked for 2 winters out there in the hospitals and orphanages out there. And that taught me that politics is incredibly important. And so I knew I wanted to work in politics, but I never thought I'd be a politician.
See, that would make a much better conference speech than Rishi Sunak's. That's better than California for a couple of years. was when I was a magician's assistant in between being in post-revolutionary Romania. I realised I was a conservative. You're like, that's a way better origin story.
Yeah, or, you know, I what did you say? I think I joined the Conservative Club, I did some leafleting, here I am.
So you talked about having a lot of responsibility at a young age. What was that involved?
So I lost my mother when I was 15. My dad was ill for a time as well. So I was a carer, I had a twin brother, and we basically ran the house. It's not a sob story. I think a lot of my colleagues in Parliament actually, it's quite interesting that a lot of people have had lost a parent or have had some kind of traumatic event. And I think it teaches you resilience. It makes you think about what you want to do with your life. So I think it's just an interesting thing that it's something that I have in common with a lot of colleagues. So I think once you have an experience like that, you want to sort of take care of people.
And your twin brother, did he go into politics?
No, he didn't. He didn't. He is cabin crew for Virgin Atlantic, and a legend.
We're both high flyers. So
he has more luck with aircraft than I do.
But this is the thing, you see. That's what's interesting. Is very easy for you to look at your own story and say, "Well, of course you went into politics," but your brother went through the same circumstances and didn't. So what attracted?
No, but he cares about people. I mean, both my brothers are fabulous people, but my twin. When he was furloughed from the airline, he could have, you know, sat at home, but he didn't. He went and volunteered at the Nightingale in London, and then he retrained as a phlebotomist. So he was doing all the blood plasma work for the NHS.
He retrained?
Yeah, he did. He did. That's what he did. And he's now back flying with Virgin. So I think, you know, We do very different things, but I think he's someone that cares about people a lot, and he takes responsibility for things. If he thinks he can help, he'll do it.
It seems to be a family trait. You just have this amazing approach to the labour market, which is just like, well, I do a bit of magic at weekends, retrain as a phlebotomist. You know, just, I've never heard anyone have these jobs. You're
going to suggest that I'm. Train as a lorry driver, aren't you now? I can see, you're so transparent, I can see where you're going.
No, not at all. But I think in life, some people just have that kind of, almost, they're just open to stuff, and they don't see the barriers there, they just sort of get on with it, and everyone else goes, well, I can't be a magician's assistant or work in Revolutionary Remain, or, you know, in a way, so many of those things just don't occur to people, but it occurs to you and your brother. I don't know whether it's the way that your parents brought you up or whatever it is, but I think a lot of people envy just that approach to life.
I think, as I say, I think if you lose a parent, you think about what you're doing with your life. You want to do interesting things. You want to make a difference in the world. I think you can do that in a whole variety of ways, not just in politics, obviously. I think that's something that we've got in common.
You've done other sort of showbizy things, like you did the TV show Splash.
Yes.
Which actually would have come in handy when you were losing altitude over the
agility. It would. Yeah, I think we did actually discuss that briefly on the as we were plunging towards the sea. And I have a Lido. I have a Lido to show for it. So my fee went to the Hilsey Lido in Portsmouth, which is still going strong.
I think you meant at home.
We are no. Well, Portsmouth is quite densely populated, so it's pretty much home. Which was a great experience. I got to train with Tom Daly. Yeah. What's not to like?
But, I mean, the if you haven't seen it, it's a reality show where celebrities do basically Olympic-level dives into the pool. And it's not just, like,
attempt,
on holiday.
Attempt Olympic-level. I had the prowess of a paving slab, I think, from my diving performance.
You say that, but it looks so high.
It is.
And obviously there's the clip of you sort of jump backwards and then end up kind of belly flopping. I mean, it must have hurt.
It did. Yeah, it did. It's 10 metres. Yeah, so it's three stories. Yeah.
I mean, why did you do it?
For my Lido.
Yeah, but that's just like, that would have been very triggering. That's the sort of last thing you'd want to see after that.
We tried everything else. We tried all kinds of fundraising. It had to be done. But But I managed to get eliminated pretty quickly. So there was no, there was a flat fee, so I was fine with that.
But did any other sort of politicians judge you for it? Because sometimes when politicians do like the jungle and stuff, people are a bit sniffy about it. I think it's a good thing for politicians.
No, I don't think they were. I mean, the only downside is that now, even if it's a completely unrelated topic or article, there's pictures of me in a swimsuit quite frequently. In fact, when I remember, I think it was either the first or the second reshuffle where I got a ministerial post, there were a lot of women promoted at the same time.
Yes.
And the following day we were looking at the papers and there was, I think there was this article called, you know, Downing Street Catwalk. And it was just commentary about what we were all wearing, where our shoes were from, you know, have we got the right fitting bra on, all this sort of stuff. And my female colleagues were absolutely appalled at this appalling sexist stuff. And I wasn't fussed, and they was like, why are you not bothered by this? I said, well, because it's the first time they've run an article and I'm clothed. This is progress. So, yeah.
But being a woman in politics, I mean, obviously there was the famous Daily Mail picture of Nicola Sturgeon and Theresa May and the comments on the front page of that. Do you feel it's a bigger issue as other people do or not?
Just
well,
sexist.
Being judged on your appearance and what you wear and things like that.
So I think you have to. I mean, it's not acceptable. I think you know, it's one reason why I don't like walking up Downing Street, because if you're a fellow, you walk up Downing Street, you have a, you know, headshot taken. If you're a woman, they always do full length. It's just the way life is. But you can, if you know how to get through the pod, the interconnecting pod between Downing Street and the Cabinet Office, it's not a problem. You find ways to make it work.
But have you faced sexism in politics from other MPs?
Not really. I think there's occasionally things happen where people just assume. I mean, quite often when I mean, it's very flattering actually. I used to go on field trips or do stuff, and if you're a defence minister, you have a military assistant with you, and quite often I'd be mistaken for their wife, which was quite amusing. So I'd have, you know, you go to a regimental dinner or something, and your military assistant's best friend bounds up to him and slaps him on the back and then gives me a great big kiss. And then my military assistant has to inform him that he's just, you know, kissed the Secretary of State of Defence or Minister for the Armed Forces, which is... So occasionally things like that happen, but I don't really encounter... other people do, but I don't. I just think you have to try and help people if they're struggling with the fact you're a woman in politics.
And how do you help them?
Well, you can just help guide them. I mean, when I used to go to things and they perhaps used to think that the uniformed chap with me was the minister, yeah, and not me. You can quickly explain that situation, and usually people are mortified, you know, that they've made that assumption. So be kind to people, give them help. If they're still, you know, being an arsehole, then you can do something else. But that's I have to say I haven't found any problem.
So no one's ever fully been an arsehole?
No, not really. No.
Because it seems like, I mean, it's so hard sometimes. You know, you read accounts of what it's like for women working in politics, and sometimes it sounds absolutely appalling. It feels like it's sort of not being covered up, but sort of being covered up. It feels like the culture of politics sometimes is very misogynist.
So I would say that, unfortunately, in all walks of life, women encounter these things. And I think where, if you're in a position of leadership, you can try and resolve that in the organisation that you're working with. That's why I think it was important that we had women in certain ministerial offices in defence. But women encounter this all the time, and I don't think it's just about politics. And I would always say, when, you know, the discussion turns to these things. I mean, we've had most of my female colleagues, myself included, we've had lots of threats, we've had security issues and all those sort of things, but the downside is far outweighed by the good. I have a fantastic job. Every single day you get to do things which help people, you get to do amazing things, some we've touched on, you know, this evening. You get to go to incredible parts of the world, meet amazing people. It is a really brilliant job. And I spend a lot of time encouraging women to come forward and do this job. I only got into being in the front line of politics because someone took me aside and said, out of everyone I know, you should run for office. And if that man hadn't done that, I may not have run. So
who was that?
It was a chap called Rick Nye, who now runs the polling company Populous. But at the time, he was research director for the Conservative Party. And I didn't go to Oxbridge. I was the last person you'd think working in CCHQ that would ever be an MP. And he took me aside and said, you should run.
So, and what made you a Conservative? Because some people on paper might look at your origin story and say, you lose a parent early, you're a carer, you worked in magic. people might say, well, you could have easily been Labour. So why the Conservatives?
So I think a combination of those experiences, a lot of responsibility at a young age, and seeing what happens if you don't defend freedom, which I always think is the core value of the Conservative Party from my days in the former Eastern Bloc. But I also, because at the time I was getting interested in politics, Labour were on the up, and I did go to a Labour conference.
So what year was that, do you reckon?
Oh, I can't remember. It would have been pre-97.
Okay, but Blair era.
Yeah, Blair on the rise. And I went to a Labour education conference, and the next day I joined the Conservative Party. That's probably what, that tipped me over the edge.
Really?
Yeah.
So how bad was it?
Extremely.
In what way?
Don't get me wrong, there's a lot of good people in Labour, there's a lot, people are trying to do good things, but I think what I found in the Conservative Party was a broad church. Generally people are nice to each other, they're not into, I think occasionally Labour politics tips into a bit of a sort of smorgasbord of hate.
Yeah.
And I don't find that about...
You're not into that.
No, I'm not into that. That's one of the reasons why I eventually signed up.
But at that time then, maybe Tony Blair, you thought, well, possibly, had some appeal?
No, I was just shopping around. I was just checking out, and I thought
he was good, wasn't he?
Well, I think he had his moments, but he's I think he's probably got better as he's gone on.
You're right. He needs to come back.
I wouldn't go that far. I'd have a lot of time for him.
So what's it like? So you joined the Tories, well, for a number of reasons, but the culture of the party was more pleasant, perhaps, than the culture of the Labour Party. Probably true until Brexit, when that felt like a civil war was tearing the Conservative government apart. That must have been a difficult time to go through, effectively, a kind of opposition within the government.
So it was, I think the difficult thing was, you could see how frustrating it was for the public. That's the understatement of the year. And we were at deadlock. We could not move on. And that was extremely difficult. But as I say, every day I used to go into the House of Commons, and opposite us was this row upon row of people from every possible angle on the Brexit situation. And they were all there with their cagoules and their thermos and side by side with their placards. And it was, I think, a demonstration of the fact that we can have debate in this country, but we come out of it all right. And I think that's why the public are being quite stoic at the moment, even through really kind of bumpy times, because they understand what we chose to do collectively as a country.
And some of the things that were, you know, the Turkey claim in that referendum is the one that, you know, Michael Gove, I think, said he wished he'd spoken about better. I mean, obviously, it was one of the big things that Remainers sort of latched onto, and David Cameron wasn't happy about it. I mean, when you went on Andrew Marr and talked about Turkey joining the EU, did David Cameron talk to you directly about that?
No, he didn't. The two things that I think wound people up about that campaign was that the Remain campaign went and told those people who were economically marginalised that if they didn't vote the right way, they were going to become economically marginalised. And on that particular issue, on the Turkey issue, David Cameron had set out and given clear undertakings, not just in private but in public, that he would support Turkey and its ambitions to join the EU. He made several speeches about it. And if you undertake to do that to a NATO ally, you can't then go back on that. And it was one of the sort of tenets of their campaign, and that's why it irritated him. But I think it was it needed to be exposed.
So I was wondering those moments. He's the Prime Minister, you're a Conservative MP. I just presume he would ring you up or text you and go, Penny, I've just seen the telly, what's going on? But he didn't even get in touch.
No. I think it's, it was a difficult time because you, even though you were serving in the same government and government business was still going on, there were two campaigns going on. And so you talk about things that were related to your brief and what you needed to do, but you didn't discuss, you know, I think you were wrong about that, and, here's where I'm coming from, you know. We were in campaign mode on that.
But there must have been times when you're all sat around and someone say, oh, that's the sort of finance briefing, which obviously will change if we fucking leave. There must have been times where it sort of crept into other bits and pieces.
It didn't really. I think because the campaign, it was like an election campaign, so people were really focused on that. I mean, because I was doing at the time a defence brief, I probably spent more time than others in Whitehall at that time, and my Secretary of State was on the other side of the argument.
So, of the three, you've served with all three Conservative Prime Ministers since 2010. How do they compare to each other? What are the sort of different characteristics? Who do you prefer?
That's a really unfair question.
Yeah.
Which is why you've asked it. But they're very, very different styles of leadership. And I think that these days, and the way we're going, and if you look at organisations that really spend a lot of time thinking about how to run things really well, it's a cliche, but it is about the team. And I think that we often look at if there's a leadership contest, it's never about the team that you build around you. And I think in the future, that's got to be where we head. It's got to be more about the ship and less about the leader.
And what Theresa May then, because I kind of felt for her because she's such a dedicated public servant, and she voted Remain, she's trying to leave, sort of basically chaotic, and then this election business, loses the majority, all that sort of stuff. I mean, even as someone who's on the other side of the, I kind of felt for her. I mean, I don't know if she was more composed behind the scenes and it felt less tragic, but from the outside looking in, it looked pretty grim.
Yeah, I think the public felt for her as well, even though they were very annoyed at what was going on, because they could see that she was doing everything she could, and that her motivations were right. I mean, I didn't agree with her on the way she was going about things, but she is a unionist through and through, and she really wanted that to be okay, which was part of the motivation for some of the things that she did, which I thought actually would have the opposite effect. But I think the British public kept faith with her, and they felt very sorry for her because they could see she was really trying.
You talk about moving on from Brexit. You've written a book called Greater with someone who's a Remainer, and it's a very funny read, and you talk about all the things about our national characteristics. our different relationships, you know, the relationship we have with the church and how it compares to the pub. I mean, how would you sort of sum that up in a nutshell?
So the point of the book was, we come through, this is, I originally wrote it before the pandemic, but it was updated throughout the pandemic with my co-author. And it was because I felt very strongly that having been through that, we had to find our common ground again. We had to, as a country, come together, start thinking about the opportunities. And we had to start thinking about why Brexit had happened. Because I think if change isn't allowed to be a process, it becomes an event. And it's not going to stop with Brexit. People are really fed up with things that don't work in this country. Politics, Whitehall, markets, the mutuality that binds us. They want us to do better. And that's why people get frustrated at politics. So the book looks at who we are as a country. It looks at our character, but then it looks at how we are doing on all these international indices. And we had in true Play Your Cards Right style, we had a panel of 100 movers and shakers around the world talk about what they think about the country. But one of the things that we discovered was that we're obsessed with nostalgia. Go in any pub, look at the Goodwood Revival, you know, vintage is big business. In fact, we even discovered in our research that despite all the sort of castles and ruins that you have across the land, you can buy for your own garden the Gothic Abbey Garden Ruin Kit for a mere £3,000. So you can have your own ruin in your garden. It's sort of the Jacob Rees-Mogg of garden ornaments. It's it's comparatively new, but channeling sort of antiquity.
But hang on, is it a genuine bit of a ruin or is it a fake ruin?
It's a fake ruin. I think it's made out of plastic. But your garden is missing it. So nostalgia is big business. But we then ask, why are we? What does this tell us about ourselves? And quite often people think it is because we're backward looking or we're just old fashioned. But actually, we're not nostalgic about Terry Towling nappies or scurvy or outside blues. We're nostalgic about a time when things were clearer. And the world at the moment is so complex and fast-moving. And I think a lot of people are frightened about that. They're frightened about the future.
But is nostalgia a uniquely British trait?
I wouldn't claim we have a monopoly on it. But yeah, it is. I mean, there's some really interesting themes that run through. We're quite frugal as well. You know, Blue Peter makes stuff out of rubbish. We have the Wombles. We have the Good Life. We have, you know, all of this recycling culture. We even delve into how to make your own Dalek, and it's basically all sorts of car parts that were put together. I mean, basically any Doctor Who monster tells you a lot about Britain. No, there's some really unique things about us, and we look at the character, and then we look at actually what the data tells us and what this panel tells us, and what they conclude is that we have huge potential, but we never quite unleash it, and the argument in the book is that we have to modernise, like Billy O.
So why don't we ever unleash it? I mean, obviously, as a football fan, I think about this summer. You know, I just think, oh God. Maybe you're right, this is like fundamental in our national character that we get so close and I mean, obviously, if you're alive in 66, that's not true, but obviously then you'd be nostalgic about it, so that bit's true.
So I think being an England football fan and being in politics are very alike. It is the hope that kills you. Yeah. It is I am confronted on a daily basis with the political version of the England penalty shootout. It's We know where we want to get to. We have a sense of what levelling up is and global Britain and all that. But we know the things that are going to hold us back. And it's being limited by what's in Treasury coffers. It's our inability to legislate at the speed that business and science needs us to. And that's why young people are so frustrated at us. They, you know, can order something on Amazon and it arrives in 3 hours. But I have to tell them in my surgery that the thing they care about is going to take us at least 4 years on a good day with the wind behind us. So all of these things, and we look at this in detail, and why markets don't work, and why it's important that we get these things in better shape, because if democracy and capitalism don't work, they're like Tinkerbell's light. You know, people stop believing in them, they cease to work. So we have to do better. And the lesson for me, the last bumpy few years in politics, is that we have to modernise. We have to get things to work better and make those systems fit for the modern world.
And do people still believe in Tinkerbells?
I don't know about that, but Tinkerbell's light, if you don't believe in it, Tinkerbell dies. And if we don't believe in democracy and capitalism,
God,
they will die. And as someone that has worked in the former Eastern Bloc, that's a very bad thing.
Okay, we've got some time just to take a couple of questions from the audience. Now, this is going to be very frustrating because I have to repeat back so that people who listen to the podcast get to hear the question. I will repeat it back. So if we can ask for one sentence questions, one sentence answer, if that's okay, Penny. Yes, down at the front. And let us know your name, and I'll repeat the question. Oh, he's standing up.
Yeah, feels like I should.
Okay, yeah, well, that's sort of military feel.
My name's Neil, and Matt, you're more than welcome to tell me to fuck off again.
Oh, God, you asked a question at the Andy Burnham night. Welcome back. Good on you, by the way.
So I did a little research on your voting patterns, and I felt that you were a bit anti-benefits. I just kind of like to understand how you feel about that and what support we should give to people.
Okay, this is going to feel very patronising for Neil, but because it's going to sound like I'm translating what he said. He said he'd looked at your voting record, seemed to be anti-benefits. What more support can we give to people?
So I think if you're someone in my position, you have to take responsibility for your constituents in particular. But you are also part of a government that has to have a programme. So you can make all kinds of arguments about things, but ultimately, if you are having to take a cut to a particular benefit, that doesn't absolve me of the responsibility I have to my constituents. So let me tell you what I'm doing. Matt very kindly mentioned the book, Greater. All the proceeds from the book have gone into a foundation which is currently funding some food pantries in my constituency. These are not like food banks. You become a member for £4 a week and you can get a good weekly shop of your choice. We're funding Home Start. We're funding some veterans organisations. And across my constituency, about nine organisations that are looking after particularly vulnerable people. I also have done a lot of social capital work. I've done community building refurbishments. One of my projects is a Tudor manor that was left to decay by the council. I bought it for a quid, set up a charity. It's now a community centre. So what we have to recognise is that if the state can't afford to do things, then we have to find other ways of doing that and looking after people. And that, to me, is what conservatism is about. We have to recognise the limits of the state. This is why the Big Society ran out of puff, because it defined the limits of the state, but it didn't crowd in the private and philanthropic sector. And for me, if you're a conservative, if you're a Labour politician, that's what taking responsibility means. So that's what I'm doing.
You're basically a communist. What sounds things? Okay, raise your hand. I don't want to just pick from the front. Is there anyone sort of near? There is someone right at the back of the middle.
As a veteran, thank you very much for what you've done for the veteran community. Two quick questions, if I may.
Oh, okay. Well, it depends what they are.
Trade brief. A lot of the easy wins have been done. What big wins do you think you can be a part of? And second, we would have seen the headlines about Poland. What's the future for the EU?
Okay, so firstly, he says, as a veteran, he's very grateful for what you've done. People are very, very respectful at these, which is great. At the Andy Burnham, basically everyone was getting up telling him he was a legend. It was slightly frustrating. As a veteran, you're saying well done. Firstly, on trade, he feels the easy wins have been taken care of. What are the big wins? And on the EU, rumours about Poland, what's the future of the EU?
So I think you're right, we've done a lot of rollover continuity trade agreements, and we now are chasing down some big deals. The path to a US trade deal is not a straightforward one, but I have a cunning plan on this. And I think there's a lot of work that we can do to pave the way for that at state level. So right now I'm trying to persuade my boss to let me get a T-bird and zoom over the United States. But I think there's a lot of things that we could actually do at state level that would pave the way to a trade deal. And are you talking about European defence with regard to your second question?
Yes, he's nodding. Yeah. He's nodding in that sort of like quite chilling way that only a veteran
so
could.
Let me tell you one more funny story, because when I was MinAF, I chaired the EU battle group. So this is the combined
and
forces.
And MinAF means Minister for Armed Forces.
Minister of Armed Forces. And we were doing this exercise. They had all the leaders of the armed forces of the EU came to London, and we did an exercise to ensure that if Russia invaded or something, we would know what to do. And we went around the table just saying what we would need to do in our capitals to deploy our armed forces. And someone needed a UN resolution. Someone else needed an EU resolution and a vote in two of their parliaments. Anyway, we got round the table, and it was soon clear to me as the chairman that no one was actually going to get out the door. So I inquired, when was the last time the EU battle group deployed? It was set up in like 2007. It's never deployed. So I said, should we just stop this and go for lunch? And so we did. But that's what I think about European defence. You've got to, and why NATO always should be the foundation for our defence, because you need a coalition of the willing, not a bauble for the EU state.
And just on your plan to sort of deal with the America, and when you're talking about at state level, you mean state by state in America?
Yes.
Rather than the British state?
Yes.
Is Anne-Marie Trevelyan open to letting you go on a bike in Ireland?
I've pitched the idea, but I do think that we need to really invest in that relationship. And it's not just about what goes on in Washington. You know, the major cities, states, that's where I think the action is. And I think also it will help in the UK as well. We've got some incredible parts of our country that are, you know, cutting edge technology is being developed. And I think we need to act as ambassadors for those places too.
So I've got one last question. It's been two men so far. Yes, the lady over there.
Hi, Penny. You might recognise me. I used to work in your private office in Diffid as well.
I used to work in your office. What is going on here?
Hello.
But fine.
So I think with your new trade hat on, I'd be really interested to get your take on, you know, building back better and trade for development, where you think the UK's unique offer is in supporting developing countries through our trade links on you know, building back better, what that means. What's the UK's unique offer on that?
What's the UK's unique offer on using trade to build back better, to sort of broaden into...
Yeah,
can I just ask... And what's your name?
Alex.
Alex, thank you so much for asking the question, Alex. And in all honesty, what was Penny like as a boss?
God, I don't want to get cheesy, but I would say really inspiring, and actually you've made me really committed as a civil servant. I just remember how passionate you were on agendas, and even when it'd be difficult to push things through and frustrating, you always stuck by your guns, and it was inspiring to work for you.
Yeah, okay, but like, what were the negatives?
Shall I leave a moment?
Yeah, please.
Did you ever lose a temper? Did you ever root you? Did you make you cry?
No, never, ever. No, she was very, very lovely. In fact, you used to do one thing that was always worrying. You would, I don't know if you remember this, but we were at a number 10 reception once at a garden party, and someone said to me, oh, I love your shoes. And I said, thank you, they're killing me, though. And Penny actually says, oh, if they're hurting you, take them off. And then you proceeded to take off your own shoes. And I thought, well, the Secretary of State has said, just take off your shoes. So I probably should. So I was sitting, you know, in this number 10 reception with my shoes off, just thinking, oh, my God, my boss would kill me. Would absolutely kill me if she knew I was barefoot. But that was my funny story.
This is like something from a Robin Williams film. I have no idea, like... It's like it's just inspiring civil servants by like empathising with their feet.
In the only I thank you very much. I got on very well with the DFID team. They usually followed my advice. The only bit of advice I gave them, and I gave it to them in these terms, I said, if you want to stop this department being abolished, you have to get a cat. That's the only way you're going to do it. You
but
know.
Why would a cat have stopped the department from
being... Because, you know, the cat would have to go.
Oh, I see. Because the public are like happy to go to international development, but not a cat.
Yeah, yeah. But they didn't follow my advice. There are some big opportunities here, and I'm hoping to use some of my knowledge from DFID and the World Bank to do this. We're really good at lots of services in this country, banking, the law, really good innovative finance, and government-to-government work that builds knowledge and capacity in other nations, and also opens up new markets for UK companies. And what I think we should do is, as we're pushing businesses that work in those services, we should think about how we can help developing nations create almost like enterprise zones, where you can get investors going in and they know that they can get access to banking, there's a framework, a legal framework they can operate in. And sometimes it's those things, which don't sound very interesting, that are the real game changers and that really help developing nations. So I think there's a lot we can do, and I'm thinking about how we can do that.
Well, thank you so much. I mean, you're such a wonderful audience always. I mean, it's basically the opposite of question time. Instead of being harangued, the audience comes here to compliment you on what a wonderful boss you've been. Neil, I guess, was a little bit more direct. That was more of a question. Although, in question time, they don't stand up as a sort of mark of deference for the panel.
I am here every single...
Neil is here every single fortnight, so that's me warned. But I can't vote against benefits, so that's fine, Neil. My voting record is unblemished because I should never have one. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for coming. We have moved house from the other palace to here, so tell all your friends, tell them to tell their friends and spread the word. And first of all, a round of applause for everyone who's worked here at the Duchess tonight, all the lights and sound. Thank you, the audience, and all the people who asked fantastic questions. But please, a huge thank you for the fantastic Penny Mordaunt. Well, there you go, Penny Mordaunt. What an absolute treat having the Trade Minister on the show. And sometimes, I mean, obviously, the politics is fascinating, but it's also about the person. And you can only really get a proper sense of someone when you're in the room with them. And I think that's what's so special about these nights is I get to, obviously, sit opposite them, but the audience in the room gets to see a leading politician be themselves for an hour. And that's very different to just getting 5 minutes on the radio or on TV. And you realise, actually, I've always, I think, seen Penny as very talented, very charismatic, very thoughtful, and I think all those things are true. But I never really sort of appreciated, I guess, her philosophy on life. And some people, obviously I said this during the interview, just don't perceive that there are any barriers. Now, that's easier if you come from certain backgrounds, obviously, but nevertheless, that's something we can all learn from. And I just thinking, well, I'll go and do... I guess I identified with that a bit. Obviously, I've worked in politics for a bit, and I've always done comedy, so I guess in a way I kind of share that. But I always admire that in people. They're just like, well, I just went and did it. And the rest of us sometimes can think, oh, yeah, of course. You can just go and do things. Now, it's not as easy as that. You don't necessarily always get the job. But having a crack at stuff and just putting yourself out there is a positive thing, I think. And sometimes it's reassuring when people in government have also shared that and have done some different jobs and had that approach to life. And also a kind of sense of just getting on with stuff and also trying to bring people together. And you really get that sense from Penny that her focus is on uniting people and getting stuff done. Often in difficult circumstances. So that was an absolute pleasure. Thank you to everyone who came. The Duchess Theatre, I mean, I always loved the other palaces. I'm sure those of you who came to the show regularly there knew, but we've now moved to the Duchess Theatre and it really is. I mean, you come out and then it's like, you're in the West End, it's like the Lion King and Mamma Mia and stuff like that. It gives it such an atmosphere. The venue is beautiful. So come down on Monday the 25th to see Caroline Flint, which will be an absolute cracker of a night. Tickets for that show and for all future shows available in the blurb, mattford.com/live. And you can buy Penny's book there as well, Greater, which is a cracking read. Also, tell all your friends about the show. Tell all your friends that we're now at the Duchess. And leave a review if you can. And if you've got a second spare, a written review just helps the podcast get up the charts. So that's enough of the hard sell.
Have a great week, and I'll see you soon. Ta-ra.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.